This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup.
We've always been humble people, but having to be super humble, like welcoming Vogue to my parents' house.
Yeah, so one time Italian Vogue was up in Rickmansworth in Matthew's childhood bedroom interviewing, and Matthew's mother, who worked close by, comes home at lunch to walk the dogs. Matthew, come down and do the dishes! And we're like, our faces just drop, yeah. You know?
In this series of podcasts from Harrods, I talk to designers and creatives at the forefront of their fields about their life and work and their thoughts about luxury. This week, I have two guests. They've been called the world's most perfect shirt makers and are credited with reinventing this classic wardrobe staple. Matthew Harding and Levi Palmer, known to us as Palmer Harding, use their designs to explore ideas about freedom and femininity. They're deceptively simple pieces, but they're beautifully constructed and cut, and sometimes hide layers of mesh or even corrugated metal. Hello to both of you. Well, I think we'll get to the corrugated. No, tell me now about the corrugated metal.
That was more from my MA collection, which kind of kick-started the business in some respects. We met at Central St. Martin's, and it was during my MA that we both collaborated on my collection.
There has been metal in some of our garments. Mm. We did one year we incorporated slap bracelets into the cuffs of the shirt.
What a good idea to stop all that messing around with the cuffs.
Yeah, so you could just pop it on.
Yeah.
I think it was quite conceptual. Only a few stores picked it up, but I still see people on Instagram wearing it. And it's one of my favorite shirts still, historically, even though it wasn't a commercial success, it was just quite a fun, cool concept.
Mm. I would have bought them all if I'd known. I just think that's ease of purpose.
Yeah, you know, slap and go.
Slap and go. Yes, it would have been perfect for me. That's my mantra. So tell me a little bit about why two young men such as yourselves would choose something as kind of traditional and, dare I say, slightly dreary. I mean, I love a shirt, don't get me wrong.
No.
I love a crispy, nice, beautiful cotton shirt. But, it is quite a traditional thing. So how did you end up, embarking on that as your business model?
Because of Matthew's graduate collection, we were approached by Andam to start a business, but we didn't want to start it in the same mantras like so many of our contemporaries did, where they're doing these full-on lifestyle brand. When you study at St. Martin's, I think at most UK fashion schools, early on in your education, you do a project called the Shirt Project, and you just have to create one shirt, and because it's kind of, the shirt incorporates a lot of tailoring, but it doesn't look like it. It's, like you said, deceptively simple. And while most people cobble together this sort of, hodgepodge of something unwearable, because I'd had my pattern cutting background, I come up with these six amazing shirts, and I have tutors and friends ordering them from me. And I always thought, it'd be nice to start a shirt side project. We never really wanted to start a brand. And so when Andam approached Matthew on the back of his graduate collection, and with the whole idea of not wanting to follow the formula that everyone else is doing, we said, why don't we take that shirt concept? Because at the time, people were only ever doing a print in a very classic shape.
I mean, it felt more interesting as well to kind of not just be another evening wear dress designer brand. And it was the friends we had, I mean, people go to events, but that wasn't what they were living for. That wasn't their whole life. And so it felt kind of a weird disconnection of kind of starting a brand based on a lifestyle we weren't familiar with as well. So I think there's also kind of an interest in taking something that is quite mundane and how do you elevate it? And that challenge was always really exciting.
And what does it represent to you? Because of course, I mean, I sort of remember you won't that in the in the 80s there was this real sort of male fantasy of the kind of beautiful, tall, blonde with long legs. They always had long legs in kind of Levi 501s and a white shirt, mm-hmm. And that was the sort of fantasy image. But I do think that's probably the last time anyone waxed lyrical about about a shirt as being a kind of sexy thing. And yet, there does seem to be something very, very, when you start thinking about what you're doing with it, there does seem to be something incredibly modern about it, very gender non-specific. Mm. And also, something that in a way incorporates power a little bit. And yet at the same time, you're lending to it all kinds of other attributes that make that power less obvious.
No, certainly. I mean, there's like a friction there, both masculine and feminine. The power is a really important thing as well, because it has that signifier of kind of authority, or there's a smartness to it, but then you can also have a casualness to it. It walks this line between things, and you can kind of steer it in any direction you want to, like in your personal life as well. So it's a flexible piece.
And I think that comes a lot from the history of the shirt, because when you really start delving into the history, you know, a shirt started as an undergarment, and to have your shirt exposed was almost like having your underwear exposed today. Which everyone does, you know. And maybe tomorrow's shirt's going to be underwear just on display. So it starts out as underwear, and then it moves into the whole blue collar, white collar situation, where so it has the authority of like working class, but also very academic and.
But it's sort of iconic, isn't it, in a way, because of the way that it designates, you know, social strata and your work. It's kind of incredibly multi-layered for something that really isn't multi-layered.
Yeah, I mean, in the 90s or late 80s, when was that whole supermodel craze with the white
sort of
shirt
80s
on the beach?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah. Actually, she didn't have to be blonde, because it could be Cindy Crawford.
There were brunettes that were acceptable. and I think in today's idea of dressing, like the sexuality of shirting almost comes from the idea that when you wear it, you're getting stuff done, and there's a certain sex appeal to someone who is in charge of their life, in charge of the world around them, and has things to do.
But I know you approach maybe not the business, but actually the design quite conceptually, you know, and you look to sort of other areas of the arts in order to inspire you. I was quite fascinated to see how you could get like Nico as an inspiration in the shirt business, because I'm trying to think back to all of those iconic pictures of her, and I don't think I've ever seen her in anything as well dressed as a shirt, should we say, or as covered up as a shirt.
I'd say with people like Nico, she was, I mean, actually, we were talking about her in the studio yesterday, actually, because we have some young interns who
didn't know who she was.
The song
don't
came
say
on,
that.
And they didn't know. They didn't know the Velvet Underground even.
Oh, no, it's just so depressing.
They were, Nico and the Velvet Underground was the soundtrack to our business for the first 2 or 3 years, really. For us, it's more things like music. It doesn't inspire in a visual way, but music is such a powerful thing that puts you in a certain mindset and frees you up creatively.
And it creates mood as well. Does that influence what you design?
I would say it's more the mood, that because we both have very different visual likes and dislikes. And in the beginning, we found it very difficult to both put up the same mood boards, but we could always agree on similar music. And so it was beginning that conversation of like, actually, this music makes me feel this. How can we capture a melancholy aspect to a garment, but also an optimism to that garment? And I think that those contrasts and those balances also is paralleled in the history of a shirt. So it kind of worked well not to do it too literal of a concept, because again, that was how many designers were working. You know, I'm inspired by 1800s, you know, Victorian, whatever.
That's never been really us. It's always been very much just the collections always start with a feeling, but also kind of more of a opposites of emotion. So whether it's kind of control and chaos, or optimism and pessimism, even like a feeling of structure or fluidity, and looking at those opposites and trying to find where that balance lies between
oppression
us.
Oppression and hope.
Yeah.
Are you just talking about today?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it also kind of flows through how we're personally feeling. You know, at the moment, there's a lot of feelings of kind of self-empowerment in a midst of pessimism, really.
Mm. Well, we've got four pieces hanging here. We've got a trouser suit and a sort of shirt dress, but probably more fluid than you'd imagine a shirt dress to be. And then this wonderful woman's shirt that's high-necked at the front, but has a button-down collar at the back. Are these archetypal, indicative of what you normally do?
Some of the pieces are. So the collection behind you is the Summer 19 collection. The concept of that was about this mysterious heroine, sort of David Lynch woman, who's seductive, but she could murder you. You don't really know. There's
the idea of power.
Yeah, the beauty and power that comes with those contrasts. So we saw this woman like in a rainy pine forest, and that's the rain coming down on the windows. There's also this analog notion that goes along with David Lynch's work from the 80s, where you have the broken checks, which are part of the pattern of the fabrics, that kind of, in a subtle way, nod to the way that you had to adjust your TV screen to get the signal right.
So there's a little check on the navy pieces, which is like a static check.
Yeah. And when you're pounding the side, like, come on, I just want to watch my favorite show.
But what am I getting if I invest in one of your shirts? You know, for a lot of people, what you make is a luxury item. It's an expensive shirt. You can buy a cheaper shirt rather than, you know, many other places on the high street.
Well, I think the great thing about our shirts is that they are timeless. I think we have a very different approach to creating fashion. It becomes this timeless, ageless piece that can really work in your wardrobe no matter what the season, no matter what period in your life that you're going through.
So actually, the shirt behind you, the long one.
That's, oh, I love that shirt. So it's sort of white with navy lines,
but the shape of it, the style of it, it's a classic piece for us that we do every season in different fabrics.
Really,
we call it our super shirt because when you're wearing it, it feels like a superhero.
Is it related at all to? I believe that you made a Jedi coat.
You've done your history, your research, and then we have done a Jedi coat. I'm a bit of a Star Wars fan. The Jedi coat did not do so well, but the Leia poncho did.
Leia poncho's
got a ring to it.
It was basically like a cotton version of the poncho she wore in Return of the Jedi.
A Lovett green with a hood.
It was gorgeous.
why do you think the Jedi coat didn't go down so well? Not as many Jedis out there as you thought?
No, it wasn't.
I think it was the season it landed. It was a summer season and it was a light cotton trench. And, you know, it's always hit or miss with outerwear in the summer. Like if you have a really hot summer or spring, your outerwear is not going to do well. If it's a cold spring, it does well. So it's always just a gamble.
Will you be returning to Star Wars at all for further inspiration in the future?
I mean, I always slip. He always
slips the name in there.
I always slip a name of Star Wars into something. But for me, it sounds cheesy. But I mean, it's about balance ultimately. I think maybe that's why I've always related to
light
it.
And dark.
It's true, but it's the kid in me as well. I think you have to have those things that bring you joy, and it's kind of stupid joy.
You mentioned that Velvet Underground and Nico were the soundtrack to your sort of earliest beginnings. You met at Central St. Martin's, and what first of all inspired you to work together? Because as you've already explained, and we've only been talking for a little bit, you've got very contrasting styles, and there isn't necessarily a reason for you to have formed a partnership.
The honest.
Well, the thing is, there was a necessity because like, we graduated in the recession.
Yeah. And we are both very from like working class backgrounds. And so it's like, well, we didn't have, you know, the financial stability to actually just drop.
Sorry about the aircon.
Oh, it's fine. You know, to invest a lot of money because we didn't have the money to invest. And so it was never seemed like a reality.
But that reality that it initially was, to the background of Nico and Velvet Underground, you working in a studio in, I think, your parents' house in Rickmansworth. I mean, it doesn't sort of speak of, you know, Parisian haute couture, does it?
I mean, for us, it's always been a story that we're excited to tell, or really proud of as part of our history. I think it's something that's hopefully more relatable, especially for young students and young designers. Unfortunately, just the hierarchy of fashion, there's so many designers that when you delve a little bit deeper, they're able to fund their business from having rich parents. And unless you have rich parents, you can't really relate to that story. So like understanding the struggles that we went through in those first 3.5-4 years of kind of, I mean, we've always been humble people, but the having to be super humble, like welcoming Vogue to my parents' house.
So one time Italian Vogue was up in Rickmansworth in Matthew's childhood bedroom interviewing And Matthew's mother, who worked close by, comes home at lunch to walk the dogs. And we hadn't put up the dishes yet because
Italian Vogue had come early.
You had Vogue there.
And
prioritize.
So she yells up the stairs, "Matthew, come down and do the dishes." And we're like, our faces just drop, yeah. And so when you have that happen, you kind of have to lose the ego because there's no pretenses there.
No.
And there's been times when like interns were still at work and they would accidentally walk in on Matthew's father on the toilet and things like that. It's just like a really intimate situation that doesn't allow hierarchy.
We've moved since then, obviously, but we're now in just north of Hobson Square and trying to keep as much of that family environment as possible. I mean, my parents actually work with us, my dad full-time and my mum part-time. It feels like an extended family. Mm-hmm. And it's something that was a really important part of building that culture for us.
But your partners as well, I mean, romantic partners as well as business partners, does it all get a bit claustrophobic? What with the in-laws in the business and, the whole thing?
Up until last July, we had a flat in Old Street that we lived and worked out of. But at that point, we had people working in our home, essentially.
If our staff were working till 2 in the morning, then we didn't have any time on our own. If Matthew was sick or I was sick, it's like, cool, we're stuck in the bedroom in the back for the entire day. We can't even sit in front of the telly.
I mean, fashion has, young fashion business, and actually big fashion businesses have a really horrible reputation for treating people terribly. And it's something that from the beginning, we just don't want to be a part of. And we always said that we didn't want to build a business if we couldn't build it in the right way and treat people right and kind of make sure that our staff have a good quality of life and the people we work with as well enjoy it.
I wondered with you, Levi, you mentioned coming from, a working class family in Texas. Well, I don't think you said Texas, but yeah. I know you come from Texas. I wondered how you made it over here to Central St. Martin's, because that's quite a journey to have made. I'm sure that your life is equally fascinating.
Not Matthew, quite.
But there's just something about that that's just really compelling.
It's very day and night. No, it's interesting because when people ask me where I'm from, many people... You two may remember, but I grew up about 20 minutes outside of Waco, Texas,
Waco.
Exactly. And I grew up very aware that I was gay. And before I was a teenager, my whole goal in life was to just turn 18, move out to Austin, Texas, and be gay. Like, it's not a real grand life goal, but, at that time when there was no public awareness
I think it's called freedom.
Yeah, exactly. That's all you wanted. Thankfully, I met a guy in my hometown who introduced me into the goth scene. And when I was a teenager, I was, like, super hardcore goth, like, going to school in this small town of 5,000 people in, like, floor-length skirts and fishnet tops.
Parents, don't despair. You see, now he's making really nice white shirts.
And that kind of gave me an understanding of the influence that fashion can have on the world, because rather than being called derogatory names for my sexuality, people just called me a freak or, a Satan worshiper, just whatever pretense they assumed I was. And I enjoyed the idea of being able to play with people's perceptions, really. And that led me to study in Dallas at a school called El Centro, which is a community college, to study pattern cutting. There, I won some awards through a student competition that took me to London and Paris to study over the summer. I came in the summer where there was no rain and beautiful blue skies, and I was living in Bloomsbury Square, and I thought all of London was like that. And I was like, I have to come back here.
Crazy fool.
And when I went back after that summer away, I just knew I had to get back to St. Martin's. And I'd always wanted to apply, but, as artists, our egos are very delicate, and I was always afraid to apply before that, because if I'd been turned down,
It
would have been heartbreaking. Mm.
Because I was interested in a quote that I read about Texas being like the sort of like Saudi Arabia, which isn't something that you would normally kind of fit together. But I suppose oil money is oil money.
Yeah.
And its contribution to the sort of fashion that you can study there.
Dallas is amazing because we still have really good friends there. But the style there is fantastic. And when people think of Dallas, they think of the 80s television show, or they just think of horses and like desert and tumbleweeds. And when I first moved to London, And I would tell people that I used to work on fashion shows in Dallas. They would just assume it's like mall fashion shows. And it's like, actually, no, like, Dior's coming over and we're doing a show for Dior.
Yeah, no, we are. In fact, I think our image in the UK, Matthew, of kind of, you know, what Texas fashion would be, is entirely formed by Dynasty.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, when I went and visited Texas, just all the cliches are true as well in some respects. I mean, Dallas is, even though the style has evolved from that perception, it's still very big and brash, and Austin is very like a hippie culture. And then you go to Levi's grandma's house and it's in the middle of nowhere and it's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre country. It's like house, field, nothing, house, abandoned house. There's a general store with a kind of a step roof, like from a cowboy western. It's crazy, but it's beautiful as well. And it's really peaceful. And everyone talks with a really thick kind of Czech accent, and it's very like boiled sausages and sauerkraut.
Yeah.
But it's like the whole of Europe is in Texas, and these different cultures and different backgrounds all meshing together into very different areas within driving distance. It's quite an incredible place.
It's quite interesting that the two of you, I mean, not only from entirely different geographical places. I know you mentioned that you both have likes and dislikes that are quite disparate. How does that work in a partnership?
Well, when we design, we're kind of opposites in lots of ways. I'm much more structured. Levi's much more fluid. Levi, when he's draping,
I drape. Matthew tends to work on paper. And I think those are where our design contrasts lie. Like, I will drape a shape, but I won't do any of the finishings or play with it necessarily with the proportions or the fabric choices. And then I'll hand it over to Matthew and he'll play with the finishing of like, this needs a pocket there. This is what the cuff should look like. This is what the collar should look like. And so everything kind of has like both of our touches in it.
That sounds like you're perfectly matched. Mm-hmm. Are there other places where it's not so seamless?
We both have a love of specific decades. So I've always been super 80s, like early 80s.
And I've always been really into the late 70s. But the collection that's actually launching now in Harrods for Autumn Winter 19, we were exploring that kind of time period where things kind of just switched for women's wear, going from this really hyper-feminine 70s shapes to this quite masculine 80s shape, and where those lines were blurred through those years.
And how the symbolism of feminine power was represented through fashion, but not taking it in a literal way. So when you see it, you're not thinking, oh, there's, you know...
Bell bottoms,
or there's like this big, you know, talking head suit on a woman, you know, so because that can be a bit too expected.
Yeah, sort of repetitive, predictable, yeah. They seem very modern, very of the moment in another way as well, which is that the pieces that you make seem very much built to last. Mm. I imagine that you attract quite loyal customers who, you know, once they've sort of discovered the luxury of one of your shirts, probably would return over and over.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been interesting over the years kind of seeing that grow as well, seeing the customer base grow and understanding who she is more as well. But there are some diehard fans as well. There's some really great, especially now with social media. There's an amazing woman in Atlanta. Levi, you've met her.
I met Christine Schwinder in Atlanta. And she's just so enthusiastic. And she'll be in the dressing room somewhere trying something on, live messaging us. And we'll be like watching sitcoms at home at night in our pajamas, emailing her back. And like, it's just so wonderful to see that interaction. We've even sent her like gifts to thank her for like her repeat stuff. And she does these amazing like little stories where she's like a child at Christmas every time she gets one of our pieces. It's really, really fun. It's and she's also a woman with some shape on her. So she's a UK 16, 18. And when she first discovered the brand, she emailed us and she's like, you don't know how much it means to someone who feels excluded by fashion to find a brand that is designing with us in mind, not with us as a separate entity. That really touched both of us because it felt like we were actually doing something social that was good. And we've always had quite generous shapes, which have allowed loads of diverse shapes and sizes.
And was that something, you know, that you were absolutely, was that a kind of philosophy from the start, Matt?
I mean, I think so. I think we've always been very open to all different types of people just from our nature and our background.
But you have only been going for, really, relatively speaking, a very short period of time. Maybe because you're young, you don't think so, but in my time frame...
I mean, it's only been working as well for the last 4 years, so you kind of cut our time history in half, and the first half was us figuring stuff out, and the other half was it kind of starting.
We like to say we've been going for 4 years.
Really?
it makes our success seem a lot greater.
So are we starting in 2016 then?
Yeah, that's right.
Rather than 2012.
Can we erase 4 years of our age as well?
That would be nice. We did have a reset moment. Autumn Winter 15 was a beautiful collection for us. Went a bit more conceptual, went a bit more... That season was really silk and embroidery and really gorgeous, but the price point was too high. And our sales suffered from it. And it was a very kind of fight or flight moment. And we both fought, basically. And
Matthew fought. I was actually about to have a nervous...
I flew to Texas,
about to have a nervous breakdown. And he was like, no, I'm going to sort it out. And he made our first resort collection, which was just,
11 shirts and shirt dresses.
Easy to wear, good price point.
And essentially relaunched the brand in a way. And it was like a moment where, oh, that's who our woman was. And we finally got it. So, I mean, there's lots of really fortunate young designers who graduate from college and know what they're doing straight away. And it took us 4 years to get it, really.
We're two people. I think if we were on our own, maybe we would know, but then also maybe we wouldn't have a business.
Do you think it would be easier in a way because you'd have a single, single vision?
But at the same time, it might have not worked a lot quicker.
Because it would have just been one-sided. And I think one of the great things about our woman and our brand is that there is always this balance and this contrast between two sides.
You talk about our woman. Who is your woman?
Really, our woman is someone who has a sense of accomplishment. She's women, like when we start kind of talking to the women who buy our pieces, and you have professors and teachers and academics as well, which is quite nice.
Yeah, and you have women who have to get up at 5 a.m. to have a Skype call with someone on the opposite side of the world, and then they have to take their kids to school, and then they have to go to the office, and then they have to go to a cocktail event afterwards. And that's also why the shirt works for them, because in a Skype call you just see from the waist up anyways. You can just throw on some jeans after that to take your kids to school.
That's quite subversive, because you could be sitting there in your knickers, you're saying, but just with your shirt.
Completely.
Why not?
And you change your earrings and you go out in the evening and it's a completely different look. It's a garment that really works for their lifestyle.
So look, you have been through the mill, as it were, and clearly must have advice to offer any young designers listening about what to avoid, the pitfalls, or what to focus on, in a way.
I think being persistent and having tenacity, having a partner was fundamentally the thing that got us through. Because in those early years, when it was really tough, my parents, where we were based, we lived near some lakes. And when we were really stressed, we'd walk around the lakes and just vent. I'd be really upset or depressed or stressed, and Levi would be like, no, we'll be fine. And he'd kind of take the weight off me. But by the end of the walk, he'd then be stressed and I'd be like, no, it's fine.
Passing atlases, burdens. So I'd say, each week.
I mean, which is, I think, advice a lot of people give is making sure you've got someone who's going along for the journey with you. And I think going it solo, I would only imagine, must be extremely difficult.
Mm.
I know we've asked you to bring along your luxury item today.
Well, I mean, for me, my luxury, I mean, it's my backpack. It's
fish it out. Yeah,
okay.
Let's have a look.
It's probably
show and tell, I think we used to call it at school.
It's my ballet slippers. maybe that's not the most original.
But they look really well worn.
They are well worn. they need to be washed. I'm not going to hand them around.
I'm not going to sniff them. But I'm saying, by saying they're well worn, that you clearly do dance.
When I was a teenager, I mentioned I was into goth, and the goths have a very particular way of dancing that's quite expressive, and that kind of really opened me up to the love of dancing. I never had a formal background because in my hometown in the middle of Texas, there weren't ballet classes to begin with. And if there were, you were not sending a boy there. And then I moved into London and kind of evolved out of goth, but became interested in the voguing scene, which is another form of dancing popular in gay subcultures. And
was that not a Madonna inspired moment?
It was actually a gay Black Harlem inspired moment that Madonna popularized. Yeah. And there was a small voguing scene here in London that was brewing, and I was the mother of a house. It was like a gay dance gang, and I was the leader of the gay dance gang. That's the best way to describe it to people who aren't familiar with voguing. And then we started the business, and with went to the business, it's like, I want to be in bed by 12 at the latest. No good music starts in the nightclub before 12:30, and 12:30 is pushing it for good music.
But you get the dance floor to yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And so I just kind of stopped dancing, and we were living in Rickmansworth, so it wasn't really a reality that I had in my life anymore. And when we moved into London, I was like, oh, I'm going to take a ballet class, like, to see if I like it. You know, I always wanted to do it, but... And I started doing adult ballet at Central School of Ballet, and I fell in love with it. I've only been dancing ballet for the past 2 years, but I do 7 hours a week, and I do ballet retreats on the weekends, often like 2 to 4 times a year.
Wow, that's incredible to take that up in kind of adulthood. It's got to be pretty difficult as well, because, I mean, most of those ballet dancers' bodies and, you know, capabilities are shaped from starting at a very young age.
And most
they?
Of them retire by the time they hit my age.
It's all right, you're still flying the flag. Yeah. Good for you.
But, like, yeah, no, it's I just love it. Like, it's a mental exercise. It's a physical exercise. It keeps me from thinking about the anxieties of work.
So it's your therapy.
It's my therapy, really.
What about you, Matthew?
My object was a little bit too large. So I've got a photo of it. It's my piano. I played the piano when I was young. Got all the way up to when you do the theory exam. And all the classic stuff wasn't really for me. I just wanted to be able to play like Alicia Keys and Norah Jones when I was a kid. I stopped learning it then. It was something I always wanted to pick up again. And so about a year ago, I started renting a piano before buying one. And I thought, because it was after Levi had started doing his ballet. And to my delight, I guess, I just picked it back up like that. And I enjoyed it's a therapy for me. It's something I really enjoy putting a lot of emotion through. There's a lot of release I get out of it. And there's something that's very deeply personal of kind of being in that space. You create your own environment really through it.
You're like a wonderful ad, the two of you, for picking things up in adulthood, because most people kind of go, well, like, I wish I'd learned piano or I wish I'd learned ballet, but not, oh yeah, I just sort of thought about a year ago I'd pick it up and start
doing
it.
We're incredibly talented, what can I say?
Very impressed, very cultured you two are.
Yeah, people keep asking us when we're going to do a joint performance.
We need a recital with you in your ballet pumps. And we'd like to be invited, please. Meanwhile, I guess it must be very tempting when you come to Harrods to just go and look with some degree of satisfaction at your wonderful clothing hanging here, because that in itself is a kind of great achievement and a luxury, I suppose, because lots of young designers grow up dreaming of that happening and it doesn't. But if you weren't just standing there looking at your own stuff in awe and pride, where would you go in the building?
I really love the Salon de Parfum on the top floor. They have a perfume that I couldn't find anywhere else. The name is Italian. It's Arso, which means like to burn or fire. Out of all the perfumes that I've explored, this one has the most intense smell of cedar, and cedar reminds me of the smells of Texas. And even though it's an Italian cedar, an Italian perfume, it reminds me of home. So I found out that Harrods was the only one that carried it in London, and so I came here and discovered it, and it's been my perfume for the past 3 years, I think, and I love it. It's just...
I quite like sticking to a perfume as well, like that being your smell. I've always thought that was quite a luxurious thing to do.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
How about you, Matthew?
Well, for me, when I think of Harrods, it's not necessarily an area of the building. It's more my memory of Harrods, and what I kind of hold dear is the Christmas windows. And we always used, when we were younger, we always used to come up and just a family trip to see the lights of London. And one of the things we'd do is come to Harrods and look in the windows. And so I think at Christmas time, especially, is when it kind of, I have a real connection with the building, taking me back to that childhood memories, really fond memories with my parents and my sister. And it's nice now that something that we put a lot of love and effort into is now part of the building as well in some respects.
Oh, very heartwarming story. Thank you very much indeed, Levi and Matthew. It's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guests, Levi Palmer and Matthew Harding. That was the final edition in this series, but you can find all the episodes on your usual podcast platforms. The series was recorded in Harrods in London.